I just have one question, Charlie. Did everyone have enough to eat? Okay. You only have yourself to blame if you didn't. Well, when I got off the plane last night, I actually thought I had landed in Alaska. I was expecting it to be nice and sunny and warm down here. I brought my bathing suit and everything, and suntan lotion. And here it was colder than in Denver. So, but it did warm up a little bit today. I brought some books with me because I always think it's good to provide resources for people. And so I have a couple books here, and let me just tell you how this works. No exchanging money in the house of God. So when you go out there to the book table, there is a list like this. You just sign up for what you want, put your correct address down, and leave it right there at the table, and we'll send it to you with twice the amount of money that you need to pay. But anyway, so don't give me any money, and don't take the books or I'm in trouble because I'm actually going someplace after I leave here. Well, as I travel around, one of the biggest questions people have to deal with is the question today of hyper-busyness. People are on overload and overcommitted. And here is a great practical book. And remember, Christmas is only 11 months away. So don't get people ties or handkerchiefs. They don't use them anymore. The Overload Syndrome, written by a medical doctor who, in his doctorate and trying to be a father and a churchman, nearly cracked up. In this book, he gives you lots of practical ideas of how to slow life down and how to accomplish the important things in life. And don't think it doesn't affect our churches. People today are so busy they can hardly find people to do things, and people are starting jobs they don't finish. So this is a very practical book, particularly good for younger couples who are fighting all this busyness. And then there are some nice young couples. And did you see these beautiful children right here? Look at how beautiful they are. There's some more down here. I didn't even plan this, but they sat right by me. Well, here's probably one of the best books that has been written in many years, Shepherd the Child's Heart, Ted Tripp. And grandparents, and I'm a grandparent, and Charlie, of all the things you said about me, the thing I enjoy most you didn't say is being a grandfather. In fact, before I left town, I had to have breakfast with my grandchildren because I just love them so much and being a grandfather. So grandparents, you have to help your children raise your grandchildren. So here is a really good book, Shepherding a Child's Heart, and it's gotten for the last 10 years some of the best reviews by our best people. There's also a whole video series. We're using that right now. It's a great way to have outreach and get new people to the assembly. People are interested in how to raise their children. So a great video series goes along with this. And then we're talking on the church this weekend. There's a couple articles in here that you will not find better, like the one by Jack Spender on the autonomous local church. I have never read anything as good as what he has written in this book. So it's understanding the church, the biblical idea for the 21st century, many of them by the Emmaus faculty. And then, now let me see if how many of you have read this book, Agape Leadership, Lessons in Leadership. One, two, that's all. I'm leaving. I want to challenge you. I want to make a guarantee. You will find this one of the most spiritually inspiring books you've ever read, or Charlie will give you your money back. Either one. This is the life of Mr. Robert Chapman, one of the early brethren, and he was also called the Apostle of Love. He was the spiritual mentor to George Mueller of the orphanages. He was one of the first trustees to the China Inland Mission, and Charles Haddon Spurgeon said he was the saintliest man I've ever met. So I want to really challenge you. Look how little that is. It's just so tiny you could, in a half hour, read this. This is a fantastic book. And they're out there on the book table. And remember, don't take the books that's stealing. Just sign your name, mark what you want, and then just leave that there. Where is Charlie? There you are. Why are you hiding? Maybe when we're done, we could turn the lights on out there if people want to get it, because we get some out of the way tonight, then tomorrow morning won't be so crowded. All right, thank you. You're such a cooperative person to be with. Now, you've written me some questions here. Okay, the first question is this. Why is the sky blue? What other color could it be? All right, no, they didn't write that. I think most of the people here would know that. All right. We didn't open in prayer, did we? Did you? Okay. Lauren, you're a visitor here tonight, aren't you?
Sir.
Would you pray for us? The first question on here was a very interesting one to start with. What constitutes the difference between good leadership and mediocrity and poor leadership in an assembly? Well, let's turn to Romans chapter 12. Do any of you have Bibles here, or is this not a Bible night? Romans chapter 12. I'm sure most of you have memorized this a long time ago. Romans chapter 12, very important verse to answer this question. Romans 12, verse 8, and he who exhorts in his exhortation, he who gives, well, with give with liberality. Now, listen to this little statement. He who leads, does anyone want to complete this for me? Who said that? Who said it, though? Thank you. He who leads with diligence. So Paul says, if you have a spiritual gift of leadership, with wholeheartedness, or with zeal, or with diligence. Of all the questions I've been asked since writing Biblical Eldership, or all the complaints I've heard, and I literally every day get phone calls. I actually returned a couple today that my wife gave me to talk to some people. Here's the chief complaint I hear. Our elders aren't leading. There's no other complaint like it. Our elders aren't leading. You know, you could be satisfied with saying, well, we have biblical eldership because we have a plurality of elders. We don't have one man as the senior pastor. We don't have a reverend clergyman. We don't have a clergy lady system. And you can tell people, oh, we don't have a pastor. And you can have all these, we are so right, but it could be totally ineffective. It's not good enough to have some kind of theoretical New Testament principles. They've got to work. They have to be effective, and they have to be able to do what they are planned to do. So I would just say, if you are in any kind of spiritual leadership, not just the elders of the church, the scripture says, with wholeheartedness, with zeal, with diligence, because if you don't lead, people get hurt, people get very frustrated, and it creates a whole series of problems. Let me give you an example. We had a wonderful ministry in our church for a number of years, well over 10 years, with the college and career run by one of our elders. Wonderful ministry. Every once a week they filled a group this big, had a meal for them, and college and career, and it's a wonderful age as far as I'm concerned. It's the future of your church in many ways, and that's the leaking point where you lose them after high school. They disappear. So he had a wonderful ministry with them, and he just got tired after a number of years, which is understandable to all of us. And he handed it over to this next couple to take it over, and they were there just a short time, and without asking anyone, they handed it over to another couple. Within less than 6 months, we were down to just a handful, and by the end of the year, we'd have no one left. This couple never returned phone calls, they didn't plan, they seemed to be anti-planning, and finally, when we got them down to what they were really thinking, they said, well, we just want a little small Bible study in our home. So we don't want a small Bible study in your home. We want a college and career group that draws people and that ministers to these young people. There will be a future for our church. Well, that's not what we want. The truth is they had no diligence whatsoever. You could call them and you know you'd never get your return phone call. So we had to ask them to step aside, and that elder had to come back in and get the thing up and going again. Well, here's an example where people are in a position of leadership. It could be over your Awana program, over your Sunday school program, your evangelism program, over the deacons or the elders. It could be any form of leadership. When leaders don't lead, then people who are under them or are part of that program become very, very frustrated, and it actually creates a whole world of problems. So the Bible says, if you're in a position of leadership and you're leading, knowing that it's a place of responsibility, There's only one way to do it, with diligence. Or don't do it. It's better not to do it than to have a position and you're not responsible. Let me give you a good definition for leadership. It's the best definition I've ever heard, and it's very simple. Leadership is influence. Whoever you're influencing, you're leading. For example, here are three beautiful little girls. As they enter teen years, the question will be, who is influencing them? The world, their peers, dad or mom, the local church? Who is influencing them? Whoever is influencing them is leading them. It's that simple. You can be a leader. You can have a title. That doesn't mean you're a leader. A leader influences people. Someone has said the rule or the rule of leadership is the basic rule of stewardship. Use it or lose it. And people become elders, and you wonder, why are they elders? They don't ever do anything. People become deacons. They don't do anything. People become Sunday school teachers, and they show up. Maybe just an hour before they look at their lesson. So it's a very big problem. We're in positions of leadership, but we're not leading, and people get very frustrated. So I would say this to you, first of all, you need to know that the Scripture calls you to lead with intensity, with zeal, and put your whole heart into it, because other people are counting on you. You have a trust. So that's the place where people fail the most. So let me give you a couple little ideas I wrote down here about what good leadership looks like. First of all, it does have what I would call intensity or zeal or energy, if you like, or wholeheartedness, whatever word you'd like to use. You have a sense of the responsibility, and you take that responsibility seriously. It's not just showing up at meetings and sitting there hoping no one will ask you to do anything. Here's a couple things for leaders. First of all, leaders need to deal with problems. The question is, what does good leadership look like in comparison to mediocre leadership? And it's a good starting question, because really, if the leadership is poor, it's not long before everyone senses that and feels that. If you're in a position of leadership, and I'm not just talking about the elders now, I'm sure there are WANA leaders here, Sunday school leaders, maybe sister ministry leaders. So there's leaders on every level in the local church. If you're in a position of trust, you have responsibilities, you have people that are answerable to you and that you are to be directing, then number one, you have to deal with the problems. Because as long as there's people, there's problems, right? Anyone ever hear about a perfect church? You know what to do, don't you? Don't join. You'll wreck it. Think of this. Everyone in the local church is a depraved sinner and an imperfect person with fatal flaws. And they're proud and selfish, and on it goes. You know, C.S. Lewis used to say that everyone has at least one fatal flaw, and some people are really unlucky. They've got a bunch of fatal flaws. So all the people you're dealing with are imperfect people. So you will always have problems and crises. Always. So if you're in a position of leadership, you just know part of the job is facing those things. Poor leadership does not face things. It lets it go on and on until finally you've got a complete disaster. So dealing with problems and dealing with problems quickly, skillfully, patiently, carefully, not just hurting people, but you have to deal with the problems. I always like to use this little illustration. There's not a board here, but let's just pretend here's a small P. That's a problem. What if you don't deal with that problem over the next 6 months? Well, then it becomes a big P. Let's say you still don't deal with it after everyone's been screaming and yelling, people aren't showing up, we're losing people, the teaching is horrible, and then it becomes this big, and finally it's overwhelming and the person has to leave. So remember this, if you're in any position of leadership, and it's the part we all hate it, I know that, it's the confrontation and dealing with people and their problems, or if they've not come through with their responsibilities. People say they'll be here at a certain time, they'll open up the building and get things out, and they don't show up. People say they'll lead the music, and 2 minutes after the time of starting, they run in and looking for the hymn book, and they're trying to find a good song to start with, or the pianist doesn't show up, and on it can go like that. those people have to be spoken to very kindly, carefully, to remind them. Let me give you a second thing that's important in leadership. Something we don't do enough of. It's constant evaluation of what you're doing. It's a group of elders, whatever we're doing. For example, this Sunday we will have a baptism. Now when we have our Tuesday night elders meeting, we will review that baptism. What went right? What went wrong? Unsaved will be there. Could people hear the speaker from the baptismal tank? Could you hear the testimonies? Was it too long or too short? Was it too crowded? What can we do to improve the next baptism? Because baptisms are important because they do bring out unsaved people to see their loved ones baptized. So whatever event we have, we always evaluate it right after, and then we have a baptism file, and we put all our corrections in. So, for example, before this baptism last Tuesday, we pulled out that file and in the meeting talked about some things that happened the last time that were very unfortunate and wanted to make sure it didn't happen again. Now, poor leadership allows the same old problems to be repeated year after year. That's poor leadership. I don't know if you ever heard this example, but it's becoming a famous one, of a well-known preacher who was on vacation, and he was at this little church in Wisconsin. Have you ever been to Wisconsin? Okay. In Wisconsin, it's a small little church, and he was sitting there, and someone was playing the organ before the service, and they were praying and reading their Bible, and very nice, and all of a sudden a man came in from the side door. And he came in with the mic like this and the cord, and he went over, and the man looks at, oh, no, boom! As soon as he plugged that thing in, the whole sound system went, oh, man, just rattled your nerves, ruined the whole meditation before the service. So next Sunday, they were back to that church again, and here they were 10 or 15 minutes before the service. The organ was playing, and they were meditating. It was nice and quiet and very nice, and all of a sudden, from the side door, here comes that guy again with his mic and his cord. In he comes. Boom! Plugs it in. Well, now see, leadership, good leadership says, let's don't have it happen 12 times before we do something. Or let me give you another example. A church flies me all the way to California, right? It costs a lot of money. Put me up, have to give you something, you know, thousands and thousands of dollars, right, before you're done, right, Charlie? I forget how many thousands, but it's many thousands of dollars. Well, anyway, I'm there on Sunday morning, and I noticed in the Lord's Supper this man must have gone on for 20 minutes. And I don't know, he was just rattling on. He wasn't really saying anything. He was basically talking about himself and his ministry. So that was bad enough. Uh-oh. When I sat in the front row, I said, this guy's leading the music. And I just had an intuition. He's a real over-talker. Well, they sang some songs, and they paused, and he had to give a testimony of what he was doing. That took 20 minutes. So by the time I got up to speak, I had about 16 minutes. He basically took most of my time. So first of all, I was having a nervous breakdown. But I've matured a lot in life, and I just sat there and I said, okay, I've got 15 minutes, be calm, there's nothing I can do about this. So I just adjusted my message, took the first part, dumped the whole rest, and got through my message, and did not have a nervous breakdown. So when I was leaving, I said to one of the elders, I said, who was that man who went on and on? He said, oh, he always does that. What do you mean he always does that? Well, leadership says, you can't wreck meeting after meeting. You do it once, maybe twice, and then you have to deal with it because everyone else is being frustrated. See, that's the problem. Everyone else is sitting there waiting on the leadership to deal with this, and the leadership doesn't deal with it. That's why you have to evaluate everything. So I'm here this weekend. When I'm done, you should evaluate this whole weekend. What went right? What went wrong? How should we change this? Every single thing we do in the assembly, as elders, that we do, we evaluate. And we ask everyone in every leadership position to do the same. Now, let me give you an example. And we started the new year off, and you might want to pick up some ideas. Good to just, when a person comes, you get new ideas. A lot of these things we stole from other people, so they're just a sharing and stealing all the way down the line. We just finished 4 weeks, but it'll go 5 weeks, starting the brand new year for the last 2 months. We have said anyone at any level in our church in leadership, we're expecting you the next five Sunday nights. The elders are going to present five Sunday nights of special talks to call you to excellence in your leadership. Whatever level, when Sunday school teachers or WANA leaders there, sisters from sisters' ministries, deacons, everyone is to be there. And we have five Sunday nights specifically geared to them as leaders. And we call them all, in whatever position they're in the church, we are a team-led church. The elders are a team-led, so we want all the other major ministries to be team-led. They are to constantly evaluate what they're doing and send their evaluations to us, what they're doing, so that we can then have a meeting with them and teach them the importance of continual evaluation. If we don't evaluate, we have no way of measuring what we're doing. The main thing is we have no way of improving what we're doing, because whatever you're doing, it can be improved, and improved a lot, a lot. So I want to encourage you in evaluating what you're doing with your team, whoever you're working with, to go over what you're doing. And not to do it once in a lifetime, but as a regular part of your ministry to improving. All right, number three, is dealing with change. We live in a society that's changing at a very rapid rate. There was a time where change moved slowly. In fact, one of the men in our assembly, he's a real big shot in public service, and he hires a lot of people. And he has two things he has to say to them, but one of the things he has to say to them is, can you handle change? Because in our company, the change comes so fast and furiously, it is a real problem. If you can't adjust to the changes in technology, the changes in styles of what we're doing here. They deal with multi-million dollar situations where they have to buy gas and sell gas and whatever they're doing. It's beyond me. Well, that change comes right into our society here. The church is not exempt. We're not some kind of little island. So our fast-paced, almost manic lifestyle, and a lifestyle of change, it comes right into the church. That means that we need to manage change. Doesn't mean we are for it or against it. Sometimes people get attitudes against change. Some people have attitudes for change. Both are extreme. We manage the change. That's what we do. And we have to. Some of you here have businesses. You know how things change in business. What's true now, in 5 years, things change so rapidly. Personnel changing. The market changes. Same thing happens in our local churches. Sometimes the local church is doing very, very well, very healthy. Programs are all doing well. People are really rejoicing. Don't ever rest on your laurels. 5 years from now, you might not have a church. That's how quickly things change in a church. I have been in churches to give messages like I'm going to give in your church, and there might be 250 people there. I'll go back next year. This just happened to me this summer, and there's 25 people. Literally 25 people, and they know it's over. And these are really good people. I've known them for many, many years. Well, people kept warning the elders. You've got to make some changes here. All your young couples, they want to down the line, and you're way back here. And they wouldn't listen. Well, that's change when you have no one left. So managing change. It's not we want a lot of change, and it's not we're against change. It's nothing to do with those extremes. It's that change is constantly happening. It's happening in your personal life. It's happening in your corporate life. It's happening all around you. You manage it, you see it, etc. Let me show you a spiritual gift that goes along with this. Turn to 1 Corinthians chapter 12. Maybe you've never seen this before. 1 Corinthians 12. Right, verse 28, God has appointed in the church first apostles, second prophets, third teachers. Oh, you are a good man. I was just thinking of that. Third teachers, then miracles, then gifts of healing, helps. Now, most of your Bibles, my Bible says administrations. Are there any other translations here? What is it? Government, okay. It's very hard to translate this word, but let me give you an idea. The word is Kubernasis. And a Kubernase is a person who stands at the helm and steers a ship. Okay? This is a spiritual gift. That's one of what I say are three or four spiritual gifts of leadership. We looked at one called the prohistemi, Romans 12:8. The one who leads. That word means to stand before, to go out before. All right? That's a spiritual gift of leadership. Now here's the second gift of spiritual leadership called Kubernasis, which is someone who steers. So how should we translate this word? It's always been debated. Well, let me give you what I think is probably the best way I could in English communicate this to you. It's the gift of guiding. It's about the best I can give you. The gift of guiding. Steering. Now, if you're going to steer a ship, you've got to look ahead, don't you? Right? And you also have to know where the rocks are and the sand barges are, and you need to know a little bit about life, don't you? Now, this is a wonderful gift, the gift of steering a group, guiding. This is why government and administration don't really carry the idea. This is a leadership gift from the angle of someone who they see the whole group. They can see dangers ahead. They can see, uh-oh, we're heading for a problem if we keep doing that. They can see, uh-oh, we're not going anyplace. We're in neutral gear here. I mean, a little bit too long. I'll never forget, I was going to an assembly up in the, I better not tell you where it is because these kinds of things get around. Certain part of the country, and the man who picked me up, we were driving to his home, and he was telling me about a very big problem in the assembly. There was no doubt they were heading for a split, and it did happen in a split. And there were two big personalities clashing. This was a man about 61 or 62. And then he told me what they're going to do. And just the whole way he explained how they were going to handle this problem, which he was warning me about because it hadn't split yet, but it was about to split. And some people wanted to do this. Some people wanted to do that. He said, but we're not going to do that. Here's what we're going to do. And I listened to him and I said, there's an experienced man. He knew the best way to guide the church through this split. The least damage, the least fallout. So he was able to guide the local church with the other elders. He was just one of the elders, but with only question, real wisdom, he was able to see, we're not going to let this group drag us in that direction. We're not going to let it happen. And then this group wants us to do this. We're not going to let that happen either. We're going to take this course. And, of course, now that's 5 or 6 years after this, and his course was the right course. And there is now fellowship between those two groups, thankfully. But one of the reasons is he didn't allow it to go to the extremes that it could have gone to where they've never talked. Now, this is a spiritual gift. Did you know that? Isn't this a wonderful spiritual gift? To be able to guide and to see in the future and to understand how people work and how the mixes work and to see problems. Well, that's what you need in this world of change. Because things are changing and changing all the time, and you can't say, oh, we're doing so good. We're doing so good here in the assembly. Well, that's true. But next year you may not be here. If you know people, you know that's true. You would, no one with their right mind would say, oh, we're home free. Yeah. The only time you're home free is after you die. But in this earth, there are problems until the end. So leaders, here's the key word, manage the change of life. And sometimes, as you get older, you get tired of managing change for many years, and I don't blame people for that. But it still has to be managed, and it may need to be managed by the next generation. All right, the next point, a lot of thinking and hard work. When we get down to it, leadership is thinking and hard work. There's no easy way around it. And that's why it's called labor. Those who labor among you are to receive double honor. Those who labor among you, 1 Thessalonians 5:12-13, they're to be loved and esteemed very highly, Paul says, because it is labor. And then we need to meet regularly as leaders. You know, I go to different assemblies, and I know this is hard to believe. I hope that this doesn't happen here, because now I'm really in trouble. But you say, when do the elders meet? Oh, whenever we get a chance to. They have no set time. They just, you know, whenever there's a problem or a need. And I talked to a man just in a certain state here in the United States. He says, no, we don't meet. We just talk on the phone. Well, every leadership team needs to meet, because we're team leadership. We're corporate leadership. How can you have corporate leadership if it doesn't meet? You got some other kind of leadership. Eldership means that you lead together, and it means meeting together, and meeting together regularly, and taking your meetings seriously. Now, I felt so strongly about this matter of elders meeting together, that out of the elders' meetings comes really, in many ways, the effectiveness of your local assembly. So I wrote that book. Do you have it here, Meetings That Work? Charlie, have you had it here? Good. If you're on a WANA team, the importance of meeting and making sure your meetings are effective and not just wandering around in space. One of the complaints I've heard from many men is our elders' meetings are a waste of time. In fact, years ago, we almost lost two of our best elders who we could not afford to lose. They were not replaceable at that time, and they wanted to quit because they said, we don't need to come to these boring meetings to do what we're doing. We like doing what we're doing, ministering. We don't want to come to boring meetings. We don't have time. They're busy men. By the time they come to the elders' meetings, they've done 12 hours work. Why do they want to sit and just waste, kill an evening? They don't have an evening to kill. So we started to realize our elders' meetings have to be fulfilling for the elders. And the elders have to feel, wow, we'll get something done tonight. So your meetings need to be regular, and they need to be effective. And realize that out of your meetings, evaluating, planning, praying, thinking, working hard together, really comes many of the good things that happen in the fellowship. All right, one more point, then I'll go to the next question. And that is this, the personal growth of each leader. I may get to that this weekend, I don't know. See how it goes. Each person who is in leadership needs to understand something. If leadership is influence, which it is, if you are not personally growing in the Lord, as Paul says, although the outward man is decaying, you all know that's true, right? The inward man is being renewed day by day. And there's marvelous transformation going on into glory to glory. In other words, we're becoming more and more like our great God and Savior, the Lord Jesus Christ. The Christian life is a life of constant growth and change. Peter talks about desiring the word like a baby, nursing baby desires milk, so that you can grow unto salvation. Now, if you're a leader and you're not growing, you're not reading, you're not studying, you're not advancing in your Christian life, you probably don't have a lot of energy to influence people, or you don't think much about the church or much about what needs to be done. So, if you're a leader, leadership is influence. You can't influence someone if you're not excited yourself about the Lord. If you're not growing in the Word, you just don't have anything really to share. So if you're a leader, ladies, men, young people that might be here, your own personal growth, your own personal advance in the Christian life really is what affects people around you. You can tell when people are excited about the Lord, love the Word, have something to share from the Word. Their passion is the local church. Their passion is seeing the Lord's people grow. Remember what Paul said to the Ephesian elders. We skip the first part. He says to them, take heed unto yourself and to the whole flock. Well, we always go right to the whole flock, don't we? Take heed to the flock, or guard the flock. The first thing he says is not that. He says, take heed, or guard what? Yourselves. You've got to start with yourself. And Paul says to Timothy, 1 Timothy chapter 4, he tells him the same thing. Take heed to your very same words, to yourself, Timothy, and to your doctrine, because what comes out of that will save your those you teach. So your own personal walk with the Lord, your own personal love for the Lord, your growth, your expanding in knowledge is absolutely essential to your leadership. Because if you're not growing, then the group is not growing. And the church is not growing, and it's not long before people catch that real quick, that you're all drifting spiritually. You're going through the motions, and it's very easy to go through the motions. Okay. Maybe I over-answered that question, but it's such a good question. All right, second question. I'll go faster now. I'll only answer them 30 minutes each. Okay. Why do you think some assemblies are healthy and others are in poor health? Now, I did not... I want you, brother, you see, I did not write this question. Did I? No. There's a witness here. Okay. I'll just give you a quick answer to this. I think we've had an inability to separate between what the Scripture actually says about the New Testament church and our traditional practices. An inability to separate what the Bible actually says we have to do and what the Bible doesn't say a word about, but it's our way of doing things. Every church has this problem. In New Testament principles, again, let me come back to what I said. It's not enough to have some principles. The principles have to be fresh and alive and vital and effective, not just, oh, we have New Testament principles, but we're dead as a doornail. We're ineffective. No one even wants them. Part of New Testament principles is understanding the difference between Israel and the church. Israel was a people, an ethnic people. Israel was a place, a land. It had a sacred personnel. You just couldn't be a priest. Couldn't say, oh, vote me in as a priest. You had to be of a certain clan, family. They had a whole calendar, a whole elaborate ritual. When you come to the New Testament, you should see in your brain that the New Testament is not Leviticus. We don't have a land. We don't have a sacred personnel. We don't have a whole calendar. In fact, if we were honest, we're sort of frustrated with the New Testament church. Why doesn't the Lord tell us more? Like baptism. He doesn't even say what age. Have you ever had that fight in your assembly? We've had it many times. It seems to come back about every 3 years. How old? Will you baptize a 3-year-old or a 5-year-old, a 6-year-old, 7-year-old? Why doesn't the New Testament tell us that? Who should baptize? Where should you be baptized? What exact words should you do? They use different words in the New Testament. I mean, I could just keep multiple... All right, what about the Lord's Supper? Here's a good one to fight over. Multiple cups, single cup, leavened bread, unleavened bread. We've had all those arguments in our assembly. And I want to give you one observation. I've never seen anything good come from them. But the New Testament doesn't say. So you start realizing one of the New Testament principles is this. The church is not a land, and it's not an elaborate ritual like Israel. There's a radical difference. Matthew 28, 19 and 20 says, go, make disciples of where? Israel? What? All nations. The church is for the whole planet. Africa, New York City, Raleigh, North Carolina. So the church was designed by God not to be like Israel, which was an ethnic nation with the land. The land was absolutely essential to its identity and its will, in God's will and plan. And we're for every place. The jungles, the Antarctic. So the church is designed, now listen carefully to me, the church is designed to be flexible and adaptable to wherever it is. So the Lord doesn't lay out all kinds of rules and regulations that wouldn't fit in certain cultures, times, and places. There is an enormous amount of freedom in the New Testament church, and sometimes we haven't got a hold of that doctrine. And so we actually start thinking, like a man who came to our church for years and would get up in the Lord's Supper and tell us we don't know how to worship until we finally had to stop him, going, what is this we don't know how to worship? Well, you see, in his mind, there was a picture of what worship looked like. And that was you sit in a little circle, and you have long, long waits and periods while the Lord is doing something, maybe 20 minutes, very quiet, very solemn, there's no instruments, and someone might say something. That was what he grew up with. So when he came to our assembly, where there's a lot of life and action and... that couldn't be worship. What he couldn't understand is that's his tradition, that's his upbringing. It has nothing to do with the New Testament. No one ever sat around the New Testament silently, as far as everything I ever read. In fact, the only thing I've ever read is pretty noisy. Paul had to calm him down a little bit. Say, you know, wait on one another. No more than two or three tongue speakers. So there is an enormous amount of freedom and flexibility and adaptability for the church to be what it should be, because it has a mission of the gospel and the building up of the saints of God. Now within that, yes, there are direct commands of Christ to take the bread and the cup. But frankly, he doesn't say much beyond that. The Lord, Paul tells us in 1 Corinthians 11, I received from the Lord that what I delivered to you, the bread and the cup. He didn't even say it gave you a meeting. But they had a certain kind of meeting. They had a meal. Optional thing. We'll look at some of these principles. But even the principles I'm going to give you are all flexible and adaptable. So once you lose that adaptability and flexibility with the principles, then you start actually believing that your particular way of doing something, your particular way of singing, your particular way of preaching, that's New Testament. When it's not even in, it's not. You have to have special glasses to find these things, like, you know, Joseph Smith had, the Urim and the Thummim, that he could read the book. It's not there. It's simply not there. We're not Leviticus. So I think a lot of assemblies, and I know the one that I grew up in New Jersey, and I'll give you one example, a good example of what I'm talking about in case you're not plugging in. When I was saved through Pine Bush Bible Camp, a Brethren Outreach, and I had come from the United Presbyterian Church, and I got saved at Pine Bush, but my parents wouldn't let me leave the church until about 16 or 17, and then I could get out, and then I went to the local assembly, which I loved very much. They're all friends of mine 40 years later. In fact, every time one of them want me to fly back and bury them, I say, I can't bury everybody. Bury, let the dead bury themselves, you know, get a scripture. So anyway, they're good friends, very good friends of mine, and many years later. But when I first went to the assembly, I was told this. Watch out for those assemblies that have the family Bible hour, because that had only been introduced to the New Jersey assemblies about 2 years before. Watch out for those assemblies with the family Bible. We didn't have the family Bible hour, because we were New Testament. We had Sunday school. That was New Testament. So assemblies in the late 50s and early 60s were going to a family Bible hour. Now that was in the New Jersey area, which has the largest population of assemblies in the country, almost 50 today. That was a radical break and change. Maybe some of you lived through that and know that. Well, what a number of brethren started to see is that they had no meeting to bring neighbors, unsaved people, or friends to. The Lord's Supper was not the place to bring them. It just was just so different than anything they would have seen. There'd been one meeting and never come back again. They wanted a format that would be comfortable, that they could bring visitors. And so they invented, and it was a great idea, by the way, the Family Bible Hour, which now every assembly in New Jersey has. I don't know one without it today. The ones who didn't go are just, they're gone. But I remember vividly being told, watch out for those assemblies, the Family Bible Hour. Well, you see, they did not have the freedom and flexibility of a Family Bible Hour. You had to have Sunday school. You had the Lord's Supper first. That was the meeting of the church. And then you can go home if you want, and a number did. Then the others, the less spiritual, stayed for Sunday school. And that was considered New Testament. Well, what they didn't understand is they had freedom and flexibility to do that if they wanted. They could do it or they didn't have to do it. So if we got a hold of the amount of flexibility we do have, within the principles that I'll talk about this week, which you will have no problem with. You won't have a problem with anything I have to say this week. It's how you implement it. That's the problem. And that's where the rubber meets the road. And then we all have to realize this. This is what I wrote down. The last thing I wrote down in this question is, this is where selfishness meets principle. We're all selfish. Do you see me? I'm selfish. I like it my way. I'm comfortable a certain way. I like certain songs. I like certain buildings. I like certain kind of preachers. And if I have it all my way, I don't want someone else coming into our local assembly and changing it, because I like it that way. Now, the man who started our church in his home, Herb Banks, who's still in our assembly, he's in the early 80s, still very much active, just the last year because of physical problems, but he's been very, very active all these years, putting lots of hours into the assembly as a retired man. He said this to me one day, and I thought, boy, that's really the answer. When I came to the assembly, we had a great group of elders. I was not an elder. I did not start the assembly. It was a very good assembly when I came to it. And I thought, isn't this interesting? The Lord brought me to this assembly where we have really excellent functioning elders, and I write the book, Biblical Eldership. I had it modeled right in front of me. And what the difference is when you have elders who take the eldership seriously and are meeting regularly and pushing the assembly forward and challenging the assembly and dealing with problems. What a difference. So I came to this really very good assembly. In fact, the first time I came, I fell in love with it. The first Sunday, actually it was a Wednesday night, I fell in love with it. I could just tell something was different. So anyway, I want to tell you just something about Herb Banks. He's a very traditional man by nature. He has almost an operatic voice. He has sung many years in our assembly. So he liked music on a much higher level. And he certainly liked more classical and different kinds of music. Well, about 20 years ago, or maybe more than 20 years ago, we knew we had to make some changes in our Lord's Supper. No one wanted to come, at least the young couples and young kids. They did not want to come. And we were having some big problems. We were having the wrong people stand up and speak. And it was really very unedifying. And it was becoming more of a, well, let's see what crazy thing will happen this Sunday. And the elders weren't taking enough initiative and direction in this because of a lot of guilt that you can't do that. But of course you can. Paul laid some pretty heavy rules down on an open, spontaneous meeting. I'm sure it upset the Corinthians. But you have every right to stop disorder and every right to stop unedified ministry and assemblies. That's the only thing that's clear. Everything's to be done to edification. So anyway, we realized we had to make changes. So we started saying we'll make them slowly, and we introduced planned music, introduced musical instruments with, like, for some reason, you look back today and you go, was there something wrong with our brain? Like that was some kind of defilement to the house of God or something. So we started making some of these changes. And over the years, we are constantly changing the Lord's Supper, constantly adjusting it to what it should be. In fact, we just did an evaluation. We haven't done it in about 7 years. We did an evaluation. It took over a month as a group of elders evaluating. Where is this going? What do we want to improve? Where do we need to change? And then we presented that to the congregation, the changes we're going to make in the Lord's Supper, which we've made. So anyway, one day Herb said this to me. He said, I don't like almost any of this new music. But he said this, and this is the real heart of the true shepherd. And Herb Banks is a true shepherd. He said, it's not about me. I'm only one member. All those young people, young couples, they have a right to their music just as much as mine. I don't even like this music, but they need to have their music. And I know they don't like my music, but we have to live together as a family. That is the unselfish life. If it was just my music, well, then the church would be all about me. But you see, the church is a family. Now, I have a family, and we get in the car, we have to compromise on the music, because for some reason, I must have forgotten about this, young people love music at a very high decibel rate. You know, my left ear actually hurts. It actually hurts when my children are playing the music. So we have to make some kind of compromise. Okay, we're on a trip. You get to play this amount of your music, but I want an earplug over my left ear. And then I get to play my music. It's a family. It's not always playing the music Alex likes. My daughter, my wife has the music. In fact, someone gave me this tape. I won't tell you what it was or anything, but I put it in the car. My wife listened to it for a few minutes, and she goes, turn that off. Well, I could have had a fight with her and said, no, I liked it. I said, well, if you hate it that much, I'll turn it off. I didn't like it that much either. But anyway, I acted really humble, and she thought, what a good husband. Well, we're in the car. She doesn't like the music. I'm not going to play it. I'll play it when I'm alone. Same thing in the local church. The local church is a family. And most churches found that since people can't live together in love, well, then they'll have a service for the young people, and they have a service for the old people, and they have a service for the conservative people, and the traditional people, and the Gen X people. Literally, I am telling you the honest truth. There's a church in our community, when you drive past them, they've got the early morning Gen X church, that's Generation X church. Then they've got, secondly, the traditional church service. And then they have the contemporary church service, and then they have the informal church service. So they've got something for whatever your taste is. Okay? The only problem is you never learn to live in love. And love, you know, is... What does the Bible say about love? What? What does it say about love? Love suffers long. And then that list of 15 qualities, right? Does anyone know how the list ends? Endures all things. So starts with patience and it ends with patience. Love is patient. Love is enduring. So we're a family. And as a family, we have to compromise on likes and dislikes on some of these things. Unless it's out and out unscriptural, out and out wrong, then it's not just about my taste. So here's my answer. Sometimes church work becomes just really very selfish. You go to selfish churches where people say, we like it this way. You don't like it? Go someplace else. And then they wonder why they died, because they've not made the adjustments or changes to realize there's lots of other people in the planet. And you have to think of others. In fact, a real shepherd is thinking of others all the time. Let me give you an example. Sunday morning, let me explain the selfish person and the servant shepherd. The selfish person, when he gets to church, the first thing he looks for is what? Good, close parking place, right? So we have the visitor's parking, nice and close. Let our people park out. Nice and close, visitor's parking. Almost any Sunday I can watch, and some of our old-timers will park right in the visitor's parking. Why will they park in the visitor's parking? Because they want to be close. They don't care about the visitors. Then they come in, the first thing they think about is, I hope the building isn't too cold this Sunday. I hope it isn't too warm. I hope they sing my songs, the songs I like. I hope my friends are there. I hope they have the kind of donuts I like. I sure hope the speaker isn't too boring this morning. The whole time they're there, what are they thinking about? Themselves. What is the shepherd like? The servant leader. What is he like? First thing he does is, I'll park my car down the end of the parking lot. First thing he does is he's looking for visitors. He wants to make sure that the room temperature is right for everybody. He wants to make sure others get their coffee and tea, this good coffee and tea, and coffee is made right for people to join. And he's concerned that the music is good for everyone, and there's a nice balance. He's concerned the speaker does speak to people. And he's not even listening so much for what's for him, but is that speaking to that unsafe person? These people need to hear that. His whole orientation is what? Other. That's what love is. Other, outreaching of self. That's the shepherd mentality. So, if your local assembly, and I've been to many like this, turns into just a selfish, cuddly club where it's really all about my favorite music, the way I like the speakers, and I like a small group for me, well then basically, that's why no one's there, because it's very self-oriented, and you want to be comfortable. All right, next question. That's profound questions. We will not say who wrote these questions, because they might get excommunicated. All right. It is often said that you can change methods in the assembly, but never the message. What type of methods do you think you should review and evaluate? Well, I answer that quickly. Yes, that's right. The message, we do not mess with the message. You get in real trouble doing that. But the methods in evangelism, in how you conduct your services, again, I'm just amazed. If you honestly read your New Testament, there is very little direct statement that you can call an imperative or command about our services or about many, many things, even about preaching style. We proclaim the gospel, but again, so many styles, so many methods, there's almost endless methods of evangelism which have nothing to do with the message, and activities that you can have in the church. So I say methods you're constantly evaluating, taking and dumping. Something may work. Let me give you an example. We had cell groups for 17, 18 years. They were very effective. Very effective. We had a large attendance to meeting in home, prayer and care home groups. We actually took that from Fairhaven out in California back in the 70s. We took that from them. We even took they made up their own material for their cell groups. They let us have their material. Saved us a lot of work. For some reason, I do not know why, we just never could figure it out. They just started crumbling, falling apart. So we as a group of elders say, well, we're not committed to this. If it's not working, people don't want to come, it's not meeting needs. And part of it was the hyper-busyness of society. I remember very vividly, 30 years ago, 25 years ago, we would have a group in our home. 80% of the time, 80% of the people would show up. 5 years ago, 80% of the people would not be there 80% of the time. 1 week we'd have 3 people, next week we'd have 15 people. Terrible fluctuation in attendance. Just the whole society has changed. People are so crazily busy, and people have very short commitment spans. You know, in your day, people committed for the next 30 years to Sunday school. Now, if you can talk them into committing for 6 months and teams so you don't teach, then maybe you get them into it. So it's just really radical changes in our society today. Well, methods have to change. So we went from that, which wasn't working, because any size group has to break down into manageable sockets of groups. We went to life experience age-oriented groups, and that's been very effective so far. So we have a group called Prime Timers. We declared ourselves in the prime of life. So we I guess you could call any age that group, but we called ourselves Prime Timers. Then there's another group. There's like a college and career group. So they do Bible studies together and have activities together, and then they do prayer and care for people in their age group. Assimilation of new people. New people come. We have a group to put them in right away so they can meet people. People want two things when they come to church. They want to get relationships, and they want to have some involvement. Well, this allows them the immediate door of access to relationships. Here's a group for you. If you go to this group, you will meet people. Those people will care for you and get to know you. And we have a seniors group that's very, very successful. Seniors groups can be very powerful today because the whole world is gray. And they meet every Wednesday for Bible study, and they do lots of activities. And tried to get others to come to their seniors group. And they do a lot of ministry to their own seniors. Dave the Elder's tons and tons of work. In fact, I would have to say that really almost all the funerals they've done themselves, elders haven't even do that. And hospital visitation, so it saves us many, many hours. All right, let that go now. Why is that many young people grow up in the assembly and start going to other churches after they reach adulthood? Well, I think maybe I've answered some of that, because it just isn't relevant anymore. The changes that are really, in many ways, if we could see it honestly, the changes that most assemblies need to make are really not doctrinal changes at all. They're really minimal changes. And if they would make them, maybe they could keep some people. But again, it's this inflexibility we have to change and tying down traditions as if it's something biblical. That's the only reason I can think why many are leaving. And it's true, they are leaving. We've had five assemblies in Colorado close up. And I know all of them. And all of them had the same problem. An inability to make adjustments and changes. And the couple just gave up after a while. Said, there's no way this will ever be different. All right, what are some of the ways the assembly reached new families in the community? Very good one. Here's some ways to reach people, and this is again evaluation. What worked 10 years ago doesn't work today. As far as we're finding out, one of the best ways are ladies' home Bible studies. My, oh my. I think of a number of people that are in our assembly today as a result of home Bible studies. That my wife has seen several ladies saved. It's just home Bible studies. Women seem to be much better evangelists than men. I think men like to argue too much, or they get too uptight, where women just share the gospel and tell the story. And also, women have more natural contact to the children, neighborhood, schools, or whatever. And it's not as intimidating. Men just sort of see each other in a fight, and they don't want to, you know, go to Bible study. So we have found the home Bible studies, particularly the ladies' home Bible studies, to be very effective. Another very effective means is just really, today, I think in our society, more and more, it's personal relationships. So here's where the assembly has to, on a very, very regular basis. Now, tomorrow night will be our last in a series of five Sunday nights for all our leaders. And the last one will be done by two of our elders on evangelism. And most of them will be on personal evangelism. And when the summer comes, we're going to do four midweek whole meal like this for... let me just give you an idea what we're going to do this summer. We've done this for almost 25 years. It's a perfect example how methods change. In the middle of the summer, June, July, August, in Colorado, to get people out on a Wednesday night, okay, it's just about impossible. Maybe if you had Billy Graham and Francis Schaeffer and a bunch of people, maybe. But in the middle of the summer, you can stay on your head. People are not going to come. The reason is, in our culture, people want to get outside. It's a long winter, and they want to get to the mountains. And the weather's beautiful, we have humidity, it's hard to get them to come for an hour, right? Okay, so about 25 years ago, or maybe even longer, we thought of this idea. We'll hire a cook, have a great meal, and we'll offer classes, and the people can come to the meal, and they don't even have to stay for classes, we told them that, but come have fellowship at least. And then we'll have four or five classes, elective classes, and we'll have things for the children, okay? Now,
We had some very good Bible teachers. People like Dave McLeod was one of the teachers in our assembly. Maybe you get 30. You're lucky. Real lucky. 30, 35, 40 in a summer. And that's a good night. You know, be a really good sermon. We started the first with 200. The meal did it. The right idea. And they liked selected classes. Now, this summer, we had, we call it four summer nights. I don't think any night we went under 200. Full meal, all cooked. You go to classes, and they're staying for 3+ hours. See, with the right method, the right idea hit. And it's been very, very successful. And this summer, we did a big cooking contest, a big cook-off contest. And that was, we had all the different groups line up to try to win this contest. And so that was a real challenge. And some of them did tremendous meals. Well, anyway, this whole idea of method and thinking about what will reach people is what you have to do. Sunday mornings, whether we like it or not, it's still an evangelistic time. Because in the American mind, Sunday mornings when you go to church, okay? You're not going to fight that. That it's ingrained, I mean, deep into the mind. Sunday morning you go to church. Even if you're not saved, it's ingrained into your mind. I have unsaved cousins and aunts and uncles. They will go to church every Sunday. I don't know if they've ever learned to sing in all the years they go. Then they go down to Atlantic City when they're done. But they know you go to church. It's ingrained. It's part of the culture. So we realize that. Sunday morning, your preaching service, even though you have it pointed at the saints, we insist that there is an evangelistic appeal every Sunday, because we know every Sunday we will have unsaved. Every Sunday. It's not even ever happened that we don't have unsaved. Now, here's what we've told our congregation. We've told our congregation this. Sunday morning, 11 o'clock, we as elders will do our very best that we have good music, we will have our very best preachers, and we will preach the gospel, and it will be a service that you will be confident to bring people to. Now, everybody has contact. Campus Crusade for Christ says that everyone has minimum 75 people that you're in regular contact with. Postmen, relatives, neighbors, the people you work with. Now, some of you in a church situation probably have hundreds of people you're weekly in contact with. Here's maybe 70 people right here. Now, if the people in your local church are excited about the meeting on Sunday morning, guess what you'll do? You don't even know you're doing it. You will invite people. If you're not confident, if you know, oh, maybe this is going to really be boring this week, or the music will be horrible, and the speaker will be snoring within seconds, you will not say this, you'll not think this out, but you're not going to bring your relatives and friends. You won't do it. Okay? So I'm saying to you, whether we like it or not, Sunday morning is still an evangelistic time, and still, if you tell the people, we are going to work our best to make sure that you can bring an unsaved person. We're geared for it. We're ready for it. We're going to give you Bible teaching. But in that Bible teaching, the gospel will be presented. And the Bible teaching will have lots of life application and will be practical. Now, our church has been very blessed with a lot of excellent Bible teachers, but most of them can't preach on Sunday morning. They'll kill you. They'll kill you. They're feeding giraffes. So, here's what we did to give them an opportunity. We have Sunday night school. So on Sunday night, we have Romans taught, we have a men's class, we have a doctrine course taught, and there they can get deep into the Greek, and they can do doctrine, they can do history. You cannot do that Sunday morning at 11 o'clock if you have visitors. You can't. They will die. I have a perfect illustration of this. A friend of mine calls me from New Jersey. He says, my daughter's moving to Colorado. I'd like her to visit your assembly. She moves to Colorado. Her husband's unsaved. And so the unsaved husband and her come Sunday morning. It was a disaster. The man that got up to speak must have lost his mind. That's the only thing I can think of, because I've known him a long time. And he speaks on the Holy Trinity, and I could barely understand it. It was so deep. It was the Council of Chalcedon, and it was, I'm sitting here going, that lady never came back. Of course, there was no way she'd get her husband back. They were snoozing within 5 minutes. So was everyone else. It was horrible. I couldn't believe it. It's lucky that I'm a man of love, because I wanted to go up there and crack him in the head. I have no idea what happened to him. It was totally inappropriate. Totally inappropriate. Now, if he wants to do that on Sunday night, four or five Christians who are real deep and real scholarly, and that really they enjoy it, there's nothing wrong with that. That's good. But that was not appropriate for that situation. Now, this comes back to leadership and evaluation. We evaluate every Sunday morning. Now, that might not seem spiritual to you, but we have evaluated for so many years as part of the warp and woof of our job. We evaluate. What do we need to change? What went well? And we always like to tell people when things go well. Don't just tell people things are bad. People get the idea the only time we hear from the elders is if it's bad. No. Make sure they hear from you positive most of the time. And once in a while, bad. And sometimes we've had to stop certain solos lately. They're just not edifying, and there were certain things happening. We noticed a pattern coming. Had to get a hold of it. Got some people mad, but we knew it was the best for the congregation. And our promise to the congregation was that at 11 o'clock, we would have a meeting that they could have confidence in bringing people to, and they would know that their guests and their visitors would find this something they'd like to return to. So Sunday morning is still an evangelistic time. Your Awana youth programs are always still, again, a good way to contact people. I think we missed the boat on these, but we're not aggressive enough. When the kids come from other church nests or other places, try to do some visiting. Go after them. Another area is this whole area. I don't know if you have any college and career, but that's a wonderful age where people are on their own now and they're starting to really think. A lot of people get saved in college and career. We've brought in a lot of people through the door of the college and career group. So it's been an excellent group to enter people into. And then we call it fish ponds. Fish ponds are seeking out, for example, oh, let me give you one more big point for taking notes. If you're serious about evangelism, you have to have an evangelistic committee. Now, I don't join committees because I have enough work to do, but I am on the evangelism committee to show it's important to our church. Two elders are on the evangelistic committee. And I'm there for no other reason, just to show this is important. Something's important when you show up. Not when you say, go, God bless you, go do that, you know, let us know this problem. The evangelism committee is always thinking about evangelism methods. So we call these fish ponds. So we're planning the next fish pond. We just finished the Christmas one. Easter is, without any question in America, the biggest one Sunday for unsaved. So I can guarantee you before the Lord, never, that I can remember on an Easter morning we have less than 50 unsaved people, less. I can count up to 75 and 80 unsaved because we've got every door guarded and we're watching the people come in, greeting all the new people with literature. We train the congregation for Easter. And what we do for Easter is we have a whole meal for Easter in the morning. Pancakes, the weather's good, most years it's been good. We have an outside pancake roast. We advertise it in the newspaper and that. Pancakes, eggs, a big breakfast. We serve it twice. So an earlier service. The whole Sunday is geared to evangelism. We have trained the congregation. Go out after people you don't know. Every year we pick up people this way. That's a fish pond. American Easter, you go to church. So let's be ready for it. Why fight it? Let's be ready for it. So the evangelism committee is planning that event and all that has to go into that. Then the next big fish pond will be either the 4th of July or Labor Day, where we'll do a big thing out at a farm. We'll put on we've done this. We've had up to 700-800 people come to a big giant picnic where we'll have rides there and all kinds of things. Again, preparing the people for it to be friendly, outreaching, bring friends. Now, Christmas is another big one. We did Christmas in the barn 5 years in a row. Rent a big barn, have music in there about a week or two before Christmas, horses in there, and the kids pack it in, serve hot dogs and chili and stuff like that. A couple of years, people start thinking, Christmas in the barn. Tremendous outreach. That's called a fish pond. There's many. Thanksgiving's a fish pond. Christmas, we use several fish ponds. Valentine's Day. These are natural holidays, natural things that you can grab a hold of. People want to do something, you say, bring in the fish, and we'll fish for them. Okay? So, I would say, when you talk about evangelism, if you want to get serious about evangelism, you got to have a group of people thinking about evangelism. Just like you have a group of people thinking about the pastoral ministry of the church, group of people thinking about the practical ministries of the church or the building, you have to have a group meeting regularly, thinking about evangelistic idea. Let me just tell you another one we did this year, new. This year, and again, it's not just doing something. You've got to train the people, bring the congregation along. We tried this year lots of literature for Christians. You have relatives you write to, neighbors you write to. If you don't, why don't you try this year? We got all kinds of great booklets for people to send to their relatives and friends all geared towards Christmas. And to try to get our congregation to realize they can use the Christmas holidays for outreach. To all the people they're already going to write to anyway, we're going to help you. We had all kinds of special Christmas cards made up with the gospel on them. We had good tracts. We had booklets, books. We had everything all there. Then we took a number of weeks to tell the congregation, now, we've got this here for you. Here's how to use this in evangelism. Now, if you keep that before the congregation starts thinking evangelistically. Okay? Just last Sunday, before we're transitioning, just before we transition into our next series, we took a couple weeks just to get these scattered sermons. And we spoke on worship one Sunday and the next Sunday on evangelism to keep it. Because before the congregation, because basically we're all lazy evangelistically. Most of us are lazy. I'm lazy. If I don't force myself to carry tracts, I carry tracts in my little day timer because basically not only am I losing my hair, I'm losing my mind. I would forget to carry these with me. So I stick them in here, I stick them in my jacket pocket, so I always have good literature. Now today we went to the restaurant, right Jerry, went to the restaurant, and we met the waiter, and by the time we were done at the end of the meal, he would have taken anything we gave him, and I gave him this good Deion Sanders tract. Did you know who this guy is? Yes. I said, I'd like you to read this. I put my name and phone number in the back. Think of this thought. Jerry, think of this. This is easy for you. Every time you go to a restaurant, someone is being paid to be nice to you. Isn't that a great thought, Jerry? They're being paid money to be nice to you. All you have to do is just smile a little bit, look at that person, and you've got a relationship and a contact. Every time you go to a restaurant, how many go to a restaurant at least once a week? Okay? So every week you've got contact. All you have to do is be friendly. That's all. You don't have to be Billy Graham. Just be friendly. Smile. Get their name. Give them your name. Don't leave them a terrible tip, though. Give them a good tip. Tell them you appreciate what they do. And then have literature with you. Now, you've got to just keep pouring that out on the congregation so they all start thinking that way. Every time I go to a restaurant, I have an evangelistic opportunity. Now, last Sunday I spoke on this at our assembly, right? And then after we had some people come to our house, and we got down, we sat at the table, and the lady said, I got to tell you a story. I said, okay. She said, that was neat what you said about the restaurant, because I was a waitress and got saved in Miami, Florida, to a brother in the assembly down there who came into the restaurant regularly and was so friendly and nice to me and gave me literature and prayed for me, I got saved. Isn't that a neat story? I wish I had that story when I was speaking. Now, do you want to know something? Those opportunities are around you all the time. You just don't see them. Postman, UPS man, people at the gas station where you go regularly. I go to regular restaurants and gas stations, so I know I will build relationships if I go there. And if I smile and I just be nice to them, you'd be surprised how many people come into a restaurant and they're just nasty. Or they're into themselves so much. It's selfishness. And when someone looks at them and gets their name and is friendly, someone at the grocery store and you talk, it's amazing how you wake these people up. And then you need to be prepared. Be prepared. Can I show you one verse and then I'll close? One verse. Colossians. This is a great verse. You ever hear people say, are Christian people to witness or only full-time workers and apostles and evangelists? You ever hear that? That used to be a big debate one time. Are the commands to witness for every Christian or are they only for evangelists and apostles and people like that? Well, I can answer that so easily. Colossians 4, verse 5 and 6. Speaking to the whole church, Paul says, conduct yourselves, you Christians are Colossi, with wisdom towards outsiders. Well, who are outsiders? What?
unsaved.
They're not in the house of God. Making the most of the opportunity. Now, the old King James used to say redeeming the time. It sounded like get your calendar out and redeem the time. That's not what he says. He is saying buy up opportunities. What's the context? Wisdom towards outsiders. So, what is it like if you're a car salesman? You're a car salesman, you're on the car lot, and you see some people coming in on the lot, you go back inside and watch television? You go in and say, boy, it's time for coffee? What do? You buy up the opportunity. Hey, finally a customer. And the man comes down the lot, you walk by, if you need any help, just call me. Lord, let them buy. I need my mortgage paid this month. No, you buy up that opportunity. Now, what he says is, when you're with outsiders, act in wisdom and grab those opportunities, those seasons of the soul. Buy them up. Grab a hold. This is actually a word from the marketplace. Seize them, buy them up, grab a hold of them. Now, that's not all that he says. Look at what he says. About the unsaved, you're living in wisdom before them. You're jumping on opportunities with them. Let your speech always be with grace when you're witnessing, as though seasoned with salt. In other words, make it attractive. Don't be argumentative. Don't be nasty. Don't be a know-it-all. Season your words. You know what I found with most people? If they want to argue about something, let them argue about it. Say thank you. Then go on, do what you want to say. Once they blow out all their steam, they feel better. But don't stand there and argue with them. That just doesn't do anything. So that you will know how you should respond to each individual person. That's all about evangelism. One-on-one evangelism with people. Seizing opportunities. Now, in our state, we've had so little snow, it doesn't even make sense. But in our neighborhood, people pull up to the house, and they press a little button, the garage door goes up, and they drive in. You could go months without seeing them. You wonder if anyone's in there. But when it snows, guess what happens? They all come out, and that's the time to run out in the street and say, can I help you? Opportunity. Get to meet them. You can't even hardly meet them half the time. It's a real problem in our society. We have met all our neighbors via crises. Lady across the street, I knew her husband had a very bad heart. He had already had a couple heart attacks. I saw the ambulance pull up. I knew immediately what it was. I went running into the house. He was on the floor. The ambulance men were right behind me. I got her in the other room. Now, we've been in this neighborhood for a number of years. I could not break through this couple. Just could not. They weren't going to let us in. So there's nothing I can do about it. At that point, just pray. I have a list of unsaved people I pray for every day. And they're one of them. So anyway, I dealt with her. He died. I said, would you like me to do the funeral? I did the funeral. We're the best of friends now. Best of friends. She doesn't leave her house for anything without calling us. And we tell her, and we've had her over. We've had her to the church. But they would tell us, we haven't even thought of this as a thought. So we built a friendship. Why? To redeem the time, redeem the opportunity. That was a key opportunity in her life. I could have just said, well, nothing I can do. I'm not a doctor. And we brought food over. So now we've become good friends. Now she's not saved yet, but at least we've got wonderful contact with her. Redeem the time. Walk with wisdom towards outsiders. Okay, I have said enough. I've taken up a whole hour here. And maybe someone does want to know why the sky is blue. And I can answer that very easily. I don't know. God made it that way. That's the only answer. All right. We can either be dismissed, or if you have a question or two, or you want to add something or disagree. Yes, brother. Yes. Here's what we do. There's an evangelistic committee. Now, the evangelistic committee will lay out the year. Here are the fish ponds, and they'll get a group of people to run them. So, for example, we were planning the Easter one now. So we will not run that, but we'll get a group together. They'll all know what their assignments are. It's all in a file folder, because over the years, every time we've had the Easter thing, which is one of our biggest in the year, we evaluate it. They get a file folder. It tells them everything to do. Everything's laid out. So a group of people, and it will take a lot of people, they will run this for this year. Next year we'll use another group because they just wear people out on it. And then that group doesn't have to do the next one because you just can't. People are too busy. But if they know once a year, a lot of people will be involved, we'll run it. But we lay them all out, we plan them, or we pull them back. Some years we don't do the same thing each year. This year we pull Christmas in the barn out. Good to not just do it every year, break up the cycle on some of these things and try something different. But that's what the committee does. It looks the year over, we try to plan different events, we plan some strategies, what do we need to do, what messages throughout the year. Like one we just talked about the other day was, in October, do a special weekend, Thursday night, Friday night, Saturday night, and Sunday, on Pilgrim's Progress, because most modern people have heard about it, they don't know anything about it. You use that as an evangelistic tool, using slides, and we got these slides from this brother who drew them all out, to see if we could get them to bring their children or something, and it will all be visually done with a speaker going through the story. So that was an idea we're thinking of for October. So the Evangelism Committee is always thinking of ideas, and then we'll hand that off to someone to do. Find the speaker for that. Even when we bring an evangelist in, like Sam Dalton or someone like that, we had him in last year. We decided we hadn't had him for a number of years. Certain people, you know, you can't have them every year. Just you lose the punch. So we'll plan. We're going to have an evangelistic Sunday. Let people know in advance. Here's what's going to happen. Here's the speaker. This is a great Sunday to invite guests and visitors. Tell them it's a wonderful speaker. You'll enjoy this man. He's a black man. He has an interesting story. He's very dynamic as a speaker. I think many people say. So just we're always thinking, planning, hand it off to others. And then we get the youth groups to do the same, by the way. We have the youth group leader there. What are you doing evangelistically? We had him take the whole youth group to Dare to Share. It's a program that teaches teens how to witness.